Time flies, even when you're not having fun, as is happening in Ukraine. It's now 3 years into the, or 3 years since the invasion of Ukraine by its neighbor, Russia. It's very interesting how the narrative appears to have changed in certain fora. It is forgotten that Russia is ruled by an autocrat who is pretty much a president for life and who comes from the Secret Service. And he decided one day, he woke up, I suppose, and decided that he wanted to expand his empire. And the first step on that journey was Ukraine, which is his close neighbor. And our friend Ronnie Aptika, one of the co-founders of Internet Solutions, which was a key part of Dimension Data, and who turned into filmmaking once he sold his share of that business, happened to be in Ukraine at the time. We spoke a lot to Ronnie at that time. It's time for a catch-up and, more importantly, a focus on a project that he's been doing, which I've been watching, which is a movie that, gives the story of pre-invasion Ukraine, at invasion Ukraine, and today. Ronnie, good to talk to you. Where are you at the moment?
Derek, I'm in London. We got to London at the end of last year. We were in Poland for almost 2 years. And I was going back and forth between Wrocław, which is in southern Poland, about 4 hours from Berlin, just to give you some geography, in the car. And I was going back and forth between Kiev and Wrocław. And then we have a little boy, and because he was, you know, ready to go to school, we decided to try and come to the UK and get him into a British school, which we did, took a bit of effort. And I now go back and forth between London and Kiev. It's a little bit more time and effort, but kind of that's my existence. I'm in London today.
And you really have developed a love for Ukraine. It hasn't just happened. When we spoke before the invasion, you were pretty bullish on the country, and it struck me that this was a place you wanted to spend the rest of your life in.
I couldn't have said it better. I thought I'd be there till I was old and gray, and I hope I still can be. You know, as a tech entrepreneur and as a storyteller, it suited me. And as someone who's quite pale, as you probably well know, you know, the colder climate and the tech kind of landscape there, which they are they're known to be the tech hub of Europe. And also filmmaking was opening up before. We always forget the pandemic. And as they say in Ukraine, those were the good days. You know, nothing good about the pandemic, but compared to the war, they'll take, you know, we'll have pandemic back in a flash. But filmmaking was developing too. Kiev was challenging Prague as a Hollywood destination. And I remember 2018, 2019, and even before, but especially those years running up to the pandemic, there was always sightings in the local news of stars in Ukraine, in the capital, with film projects. And then, of course, the pandemic came and everything stopped globally. And then when I thought it was all systems go again in January 2022, when the pandemic was ending, as you said, their neighbor had other plans. And it's a terrible tragedy. Nobody in Kiev understands why, like, you know, is this war. No one was walking around America going, let's invade Russia. It's nonsense. You know, who was invading Russia? So why Russia attacked Ukraine? I mean, they say there's so many narratives they put out there in their propaganda. Ukraine was about to attack them. It's just no one knows what that even means. You know, Ukraine's much smaller than Russia. It's not a small place, Ukraine. But why was Ukraine going to attack Russia? It just makes no sense. So this Russian invasion, it's a tragedy. It's sad. It's worse than ever. It's almost, you know, entering the end of year four in February 22. It'll be 24th of February next year, it'll be into the fifth year, and people are dying for no reason, you know, on both sides. But it's sad, and the trauma that it's causing, and the pain, you know, I've had terrible trauma. When I spoke to you last, Eric, a few years ago, I was in a terrible state of shock. The shock has worn off, but we still get shocked every week. We've had some, sadly, some friends die. It's really not a pretty story. And here in London, Alec, you lived in London, so you know everybody says it's an educated place, and maybe it is. I don't really go out a lot. I'm quite reclusive, and since the war started, I kind of keep to myself. But I'm amazed at how people know nothing about this sorrow. But maybe that's fair. People don't know about Sudan. They don't know about Central Asia, Central America. There's conflicts all over the world. Africa, there's conflicts in so many places. So why should they care about Ukraine? I don't know. But I am amazed considering how much airtime it gets. People will say, is that war still going on? You articulated correctly when they say, is there still war in the Ukraine? I said, it's not the Ukraine. It's just Ukraine. It's not an area. It's a sovereign nation that was, doing its own thing. And it was actually growing at an incredible rate. Kiev was always said to be like the next Berlin. And I will bet the farm that if this war hadn't started, it would have been the hotspot of Europe within the next couple of years. Filmmaking, tech entrepreneurship, fashion, creativity, dental tourism was exploding all over Ukraine. Like people from Germany, Switzerland, Austria would come there and fix their teeth and have a holiday. They got world-class dental practices, private medical, facilities opened up in the last few years. The eating, it's better than London eating, in my opinion. It's really sad. It's really sad that this big country, with resources. I looked on Google a few years ago. I need to look again. But if I'm not mistaken, like Ukraine is in the top 10 countries in the world in terms of a basket of resources. I know they're referred to as the breadbasket of Europe. If I'm not mistaken, they're the biggest iron ore. They're the biggest iron ore deposits in Europe. They've got some of the rare earths that everyone talks about these days in the news. There's brain power there. Ukraine was the brains trust of the Soviet Union. One of the reasons you hear from a Ukrainian perspective of why Russia invaded, it's like Ukraine was this beautiful ex-girlfriend that was blossoming and growing. And Russia, Putin wanted her back. He was jealous, and he couldn't get her back, so he beat her, tried to beat her, That's one metaphor, It's really, really sad. And the city of Kyiv, and there's many cities in Ukraine, I've traveled a little bit through Ukraine, like South Africa, it's hard to beat South Africa. South Africa must be the most beautiful land in the world. I mean, I love South Africa and I miss it. And it is physically beautiful, with soulful people. But I found the same in Ukraine with a better climate for me, with the cooler weather, and a tech scene. I mean, the tech scene in Ukraine is way, way bigger than in South Africa. It's the biggest in Europe, so it's really an exciting place to be. And the tech scene hasn't stopped. Now we are living through the world's first big drone war, and Ukraine is leading. And there were two big announcements. I read the local news every day. So there were two big announcements in the last 24 hours. The one is they've successfully tested their Flamingo missile because they're waiting for other countries like America to give them long-range missiles. So they're developing their own. They can't wait forever. And the other big announcement is they've set a date in November that they're going to start selling drone technology, I guess, to raise money because, they can't, they need funding. And there is a tech investment. I wouldn't say boom. Boom's probably the wrong choice of words. But there's a tech investment vibe going on in Ukraine. Where a lot of foreigners are coming into Ukraine, investing money in drone technology and other war and military technology. So it's quite incredible, how things are progressing and developing. I was going to say quite incredible, to see how war is developing, but I don't know anything about war. Alec, me and you don't know about war until the last 3 years, and I've lived through war and I've seen things that you don't want to see, and I've experienced things that are frightening, and there were some times where I thought we weren't going to make it. You know, it's scary and it's tragic. I've seen like what a direct impact of a missile can do, and you go, wow, it's like it's just pure evil. You know, I've spent enough nights, Alec, in bomb shelters, you know, to tell you that there's a whole story about just the life in bomb shelters, the socializing, that kind of dark humor when you think, well, I mean, you, I don't know anyone who's died in a bomb shelter, but it is scary. And one of the reasons, in my opinion, that people go down to the bomb shelters is not because you're scared of dying. That noise, it is just haunting. You don't want to hear that noise, on the high rise of a building. You want to go underground and muffle that noise as much as possible. That noise can give you nightmares, you know, and the thunder when the building is rumbling from the vibrations. That's just an evil sound, you know, and you go, wow, I don't want that in my system. You know, I don't want to hear that. So people go also, you know, underground to shelters to just not experience that thunder. It's just terrifying.
The Brits still talk about the Blitz in 1941. And I guess this is is something that generations of Ukrainians are going to be talking about. But Ronnie, let's go back to this project. Where did the idea come from, given that you started it all? It's three chapters now, and you can see it on YouTube. It's available to anyone to see, and I would strongly recommend it. A lovely, lovely night to sit watching those three chapters. You become a bit better informed about what's truly happening in Ukraine. But it started in 2018 before COVID. So what was the purpose back then?
So it actually started, the writing of it started 10 years before that, in about 2008. Me and Craig Frymont were in Kyiv trying to find stories about anything because of the beautiful landscape and the humor and the creativity. And we were just looking for human stories. And it was like a hobby. And every time we wrote one, it just didn't feel true. We didn't understand the culture well enough. When we went and got coverage from Ukrainians on the story, they said it's not feeling authentic enough. And then we left it for a while. And I basically was living in Kyiv, you know, for quite some time. And I turned my attention to IT entrepreneurship. I said, let's try and tell a documentary story. So the first iteration of the film was meant to be about IT entrepreneurs in Kyiv. And I had incredible access to entrepreneurs through living there, through some friends, through my own track record. And slowly my network there grew, and I had a really good circle of IT entrepreneur friends and colleagues. And in 2018, we started shooting this documentary. We were halfway through when the pandemic started, and then the whole world paused because, you know, films with masks on aren't really that visually exciting. And I thought it was all systems go in January 2022. And I was starting to book airline tickets that month for the crew to come back to Kyiv. And the invasion started, the full-scale invasion started. And everything changed.
Where were you when you heard about it? Where were you sitting when the invasion began?
I was in Kyiv. I was sleeping. I was sleeping, and the building started shaking, and it was like about 4:35 in the morning, and I mean, I shat my pants. You know, I was one of the people in Kyiv with mainly locals. In fact, I can't say there were any other foreigners that I knew, and none of us believed it was going to happen, even though there was the buildup of troops, even though the embassies were evacuating people from the American embassy, the Israeli embassy. They were giving, I have an Israeli friend, and he was telling me that we're going. And I said, there's no way it's going to happen. Alec, I've been wrong on every call. So whatever I say on this discussion, if people do the opposite, they should be good, because I've called it wrong on everything. I mean, when it happened, we were like, this is not possible. And then I thought it's going to be over in a day or two. It's just posturing. They're just trying to scare everyone. The fact that it's into year four, I mean, it's just, you know, it's just all impossible to believe. So I was at home in Kyiv, and the war started, and we have a little boy, and we decided, you know, after a week, it's like, this is not, you know, this is scary, you know, it's dangerous. And we left. We came to SA for a little bit. Then we went to Poland to be closer to Ukraine. And also we couldn't get a visa for my wife. It was also not the easiest story.
She's Ukrainian?
She's Ukrainian, yeah, yeah. My father's parents were from Ukraine, actually. You know, I didn't know them, but they were from Western Ukraine. Then we landed up in Poland because it was closer to Ukraine and there's a big Ukrainian community. And then we applied for this refugee visa to come to the UK. And here we are in London, basically because of our little boy. And the form had to change. Everything changed. Our lives changed. We have changed. And the form had to change too, because you couldn't tell a story about Ukraine anymore and ignore the elephant in the room, the war. So we had to change the story. And it changed from I to entrepreneurs to the people of Kyiv and how they were living this dream, the Ukrainian dream. And you've seen the film. It was a dream. I thought I was living in the best kept secret in the world. I had quite a few friends, some of them, you know, come and visit. And they were all amazed at the tech, at the eating, at the city is just beautiful. People know Prague and Budapest, but I argue that Kyiv is more beautiful and much bigger. There's so much to see and do in Kyiv and the rest of Ukraine. And the war, you know, we had to change things, you know, and the story became about how these people learn to adapt and change. But Alec, as you pointed out, as you hinted at it, the story is not over. We've done three chapters. The fourth chapter, which we're busy planning, is about the theme of exhaustion, because that's really what Ukrainians are suffering from. They are exhausted. We're exhausted, and we're not currently in Kyiv at the moment. I was there a few months ago, and I'm aiming to go back. I'm hoping next month, but I don't know. We've got some, got some visa issues. Yeah.
How does Zelensky keep it all together? You would wonder that at some point in time, people would say, just give up. Let these Russians come in. Let's just get peace back in our lives, get back to normality.
It's a very good point, and it's a difficult discussion. I don't know if I have enough insight or authority to comment on it, but I can share my perspective. Like, Zelensky's popularity has dropped, but he's still commanding, at least from what I've read in the polls, 60%. It used to be much higher. But more than half the country will not stop supporting him and will not give up. Too much blood has been spilled. They hate the Russians, you know, and it's understandable. You know, I mean, it's not war, Alec, it's terrorism. You know, I mean, they are bombing residential complexes, hospitals, kindergartens. And, you know, from a Ukrainian perspective, the world just watches. You know, it's just shocking. I know people help. But it's never enough. It's always too little, too late. How Zelensky doesn't crack, I don't know. You know, he just has to keep begging and begging and begging, because that's what he does. You know, and he's damn good at it. I don't know how he keeps it together. I mean,
And that White House meeting where he was ambushed by Trump, in the same way, I suppose, as that Cyril was ambushed by Trump. Yeah,
that was shameful. But then they had, you know, subsequent meetings. And then the last one, which was a week ago, was it about a week ago? Yeah, it was, I think, last week, Friday, or the Friday before, 10 days ago. That one wasn't publicized, but all reports is he was lambasted again. But I believe that he learned. Yeah, but I believe he's learned to, you know, bite his tongue, you know. I mean, whether you love Donald Trump or hate Donald Trump, he's got the power, you know. I'm not a Trump fan. He's got the power, so people can laugh at him all they want. What do they call him? The orange orangutan, whatever they want to call him. But he's got the power. So whether you learn, you know, to tiptoe or, what, his style of politics, I know we don't want to get political, but from what I keep reading, like, his style of politics, you do me a favor, I'll do you a favor.
Yeah, well, that seems transaction driven.
Yeah, that seems to be, I mean, without getting, you know, unprofessional, because I can't really get out of it. Like American politics, but what I see as an observer, like everyone else, it looks uglier.
The art of the deal, and it's something that clearly Zelensky understands. We in South Africa have taken a little while to get to grips with it, But, well, who knows where that will go to. As you say, he is the most powerful guy in the world. He can be a great friend and a dreadful enemy. Where, though, is he, or where, what is the perception in Ukraine about the support or lack of from the West?
That I can answer very accurately. Obviously, everyone is extremely grateful for any support the West gives and constantly asks for more. So they get a lot of support from the West, but it's never enough. You know, when people say in other countries in Europe, we need these tanks, who do they need them for? If there's only one threat, which is Russia and maybe China. Again, like, I don't have enough insight, but, you know, that's what the media will suggest. But let's say Russia. You know, that's what the tanks are for. So why not give it to Ukraine? Ukraine is doing the dirty work and paying in blood. You know, so they say, well, we can't give you our tanks. We need them. But for who do they need them? I don't understand. So, yeah, the view is that whatever help they're getting, it's just not enough. And it always seems to be too little, too late. And people are dying. You know, but it's a tragedy. It's a big, big tragedy. I mean, you spoke about the Blitz. You know me a long time. I have a bit of a quirky sense of humor. I'm a bit of a quirky, nerdy guy. And we were looking for places to stay. We just moved into a flat 2 months ago from another flat. And sometimes, I don't know, just some dark, twisted inspiration would hit me. And I asked a real estate agent, does this flat have a bomb shelter close by? And they say, what? I said, a bomb shelter. I said, what are you talking about? I said, a bomb shelter. And I don't want to, like, you know, irritate anyone too much. So when I say to them, in case the war comes, they said, don't be ridiculous. I said, that's what we said in Ukraine as well. I think the war could come here as fast as it came to Ukraine. There's a movie now on Netflix. I haven't seen it, but I keep hearing about it. It's a brand new movie about a missile that's been fired in America. Catherine Bigelow is the director. She's like an Oscar-winning filmmaker. I've got the name now. Some of the people watching will probably know it. I haven't watched a movie in years, but it's on my list is growing and growing and growing. But if the war could come here, it's unlikely, sure, but it could come here. The war could expand. I mean, I can tell you the mood in Poland, because we got a bit of a Polish community when we were there, has changed dramatically since Trump took office. You would hear last year, they don't say NATO, we're in NATO, the way they pronounce it. We're in NATO. We're safe. I don't think anyone has that view anymore. You know, I don't know if they're safe in Poland. I mean, all those drones that came into Polish airspace, it's not an accident. No one believes it's an accident. The Russians are testing. They're testing how far they can push things. And I guess if anyone is listening to this, because I saw some of the comments on that interview from a few years ago, some of them are quite nasty and, like, didn't make any sense. And people will say, Ronnie's crazy, or what is he talking about? He dreams of war. I don't dream of war. You know me, Eric. I'm a dreamer, and but even magic and storytelling. I'm not a violent, aggressive person. Quite the opposite. But this is really what it boils down to. If people believe that the war will stop at Ukraine, then no one's got any problems. And if you believe that if they conquer Ukraine and they will go further, then we've all got problems. And that's really boils down to what you believe in. You know, I don't believe they're going to stop at Ukraine. If they take Ukraine, Putin is just warming up, in my opinion. You know, his country's on a war footing. They are making more arms than the whole of Europe put together. He will send everyone of his citizens to die. You know, he doesn't care, you know, for whatever crazy ambition he's got, you know, which makes no sense. But that's the question. Do people believe that the war will stop at Ukraine or not? I don't believe it will.
Roddy, what would you have said if you were sitting in the crowd that supported, it was, I think it was at the FNB Stadium, that was chanting with the EFF, "We are Putin, Putin is us," when Julius Malema was at the height of his power. If you were sitting next to a guy, just a normal chap who might live in Rosettenville, and the two of you were watching this, and he was actually quite taken up with the emotion, how would you explain to that person that he might be misguided?
It's a good question. I don't know how to. I don't know how to explain to anyone anymore. I've been so beaten by this war. You know, like, just listening to people who talk about Russia's point of view. I said, what point of view do they have? They invaded their neighbor and started killing people for no reason. They don't have a point of view. You know, I don't get it, Eric. I don't understand why South Africa is on the wrong side of history from my perspective. You know, maybe from those people that you described, they're not. I wasn't aware of that incident, but I know that South Africa supports Russia. You know, they don't support Ukraine. From my understanding, maybe I'm wrong, but that's my understanding. And I find it quite sad and embarrassing, but I don't know why things, you know, happen the way they happen. I don't understand it.
Artists like you do tell the story through the art. And that's pretty much what you've done with this film. What's the reaction been? Yeah, what's the reaction been?
That to me is a painful but fantastic discussion. So we made this film out of love. It started before the full-scale invasion. And the idea was to elevate Ukraine, was to try and inspire a different conversation around Ukraine that challenges the stereotypes, because the stereotypes are worse than ever. People call it like that Borat land, like from the Kazakhstan Borat movie. You know, it's a sophisticated landscape. The cities of Ukraine are modern and beautiful, but it has no marketing. Like it says in the film, the difference between rats and hamster. You know, good marketing. It's the same thing, you know. So for some reason, people think Ukraine is full of gangsters and mafiosa. I never met any gangsters and mafiosa. That's in Hollywood movies. As you and me both know, so many times the villains in Hollywood movies are South African or Ukrainian. Why? I don't know. But they are. Corruption? Yes, there's corruption in Ukraine. It's a big problem. There's corruption everywhere. I would argue that there's more corruption in America under Trump than there's anywhere else in the world. And he's so open about it. But again, I'm no expert on that. But yeah, Ukraine has a corruption problem. South Africa has corruption problems. But it didn't affect me. I'm not in the business of corruption. I'm an IT nerd and a storyteller. I don't know anyone who's dealing in corruption or who's dealing in mafiosa, you know, activities. We made this film to basically try and stimulate a more enlightened conversation around who are modern Ukrainians? What do they do? What does Ukraine offer the world? Who is of Ukrainian origin? You'd be like amazed at how long the list is. David Copperfield, Steven Spielberg, Lenny Kravitz, Dustin Hoffman. In the entertainment space, then there's in the science space, the founder of WhatsApp, you know, came from Ukraine. You know, one of the PayPal founders came from Ukraine. It's a long, long, long list. And it's a smart place, beautiful place with smart, creative people. And that's what we try to tell as a story, to show, you know, this alternative narrative, that it's not this Borat land where everyone is backwards and it's full of hillbillies. Then the war happened and the story had to change around how these people, these modern citizens in Kiev, survived, you know, because of the shock that they, even the shock that I have been through. And the story is far from over, because the next chapter of the story will be about the exhaustion. And then a fifth chapter will be about the end of the war, whenever that is. And then the most important chapter, Eric, which you could even say South Africa has this chapter still to come, is what happens after the war ends? You know, the government in South Africa changed. It might be too soon to tell the story, is Africa a big success, because of all the challenges, you know, more than me. But Ukraine has got, if the war ends tomorrow, there are so many challenges now in Ukraine. Will it survive? I believe it will. But that's another chapter, because there's still corruption. Then you've got the trauma, the shattered economy, the amputees, the alcoholism, all these things that you don't read in the news. You read about destruction, death, hitting infrastructure, electricity grid, but you don't read in the news. I've never seen news about the alcoholism, the online gambling addiction, the divorce rate, which is up a few 100%, the PTSD, the trauma, the amputees. The last I read, there was approximately like somewhere about 50,000 plus amputees in Ukraine, and it's growing and growing. That's a generation of Ukrainians that someone in the family is going to be missing arms and legs. And the partner, the spouse, and the kids are going to have to be incredibly strong to get through that. You know, we haven't even begun to see that part of the pain and the trauma. You know, it's like there's so many dark, you know, themes ahead in Ukraine's survival that it's going to be a hell of a story. I believe Ukraine will survive. and heal. It's going to be generations, as you said, of pain. But, you know, Eric, we haven't seen anarchy in Ukraine. A lot of people predicted, you know, Kyiv will fall in 3 days, that there'd be anarchy and rioting. But that's not a function of government. That's a function of society. The society there, as it's captured in the film, is helping each other. Everyone's involved in the war, whether it's donating, cooking food, giving clothes to the military, serving in the military. Not everyone is born to be a soldier, but everyone is helping. And can I say something which might be controversial from a South African perspective? Because I've had this argument with a few people about it, and you might have an interesting view on it, and maybe you'll edit it out. If all the neighbors, hypothetically, of Southern Africa got together and attacked South Africa tomorrow, whatever, make it up, just attacked, how many South Africans do you and me know they're going to pick up arms and fight or actually get out of there? You know, I've had some heated arguments on that. In Ukraine, everyone got involved. And like, would you say that everyone in your circle and your circle of colleagues would go and join the army and fight? I'm not so sure. You know, I know it's a sensitive subject. Some people say, oh, Ronnie, what are you trying to say? I'm trying to say that the spirit in Ukraine is quite incredible. The unity is incredible. I don't know if South Africa has that. You know, and I love South Africa, so don't get me wrong. I don't mean to be derogatory. But there's something quite incredible about the society in Ukraine, that everyone is helping. When you're in the bomb shelter, Eric, at 3 in the morning, and sometimes it can last the whole night, everyone knows their neighbors. You know, it's there's a social implication of getting together in a bomb shelter, you know, in the winter, especially, you know, with babies, and you're helping the neighbor rock the baby, you know, it's like, wow, and
What's the path to peace? What path to peace would be acceptable to the Ukrainian people, given all of this trauma that they've been through, all the issues?
They want the land back. They want Crimea back. Is it realistic or not? That's a good question. You know, maybe it's not realistic, but they don't want to give up. They think that the Russians will just come back if they, you know, they talk now. What did Trump say about freezing the conflict on the current front lines? The Ukrainians are going along with Trump, you know, because I guess you don't want to not go along with Trump for Trump reasons. The Russians are saying no. They say they're not accepting that, you know. So the Ukrainians are also scared the Russians will just regroup and come back, you know. So, I mean, the other aspect of what you're asking is, when will the war end? And I can't see it ending. It'll only end when Putin dies, because he's opened the door. And if you understand Russian mentality the way I understand it, they can't back down. There's the strongman complex. Once they've, showed their chest, they can't say, oh, I made a mistake. My bad. Doesn't work there. They'll tar and feather him the next day. They'll hang him from, Red Square. So he can't back down. You know, I think he's more scared, I'm just guessing, of his own people than anyone else. You know, you can't back. You can't show weakness. So, you know, it'll only end. And if there's enough intelligent Ukrainians have shared this perspective with me, they can't see an exit for Russia. What is Russia's exit? He's achieved nothing. All he's done is created death and destruction for Ukrainians and for Russians. And there's no off-ramp for Putin. So when will it end? You know, we don't know. And Putin could keep going if he succeeds in Ukraine. You know, I mean, it's another discussion that also is probably not for our chat here, but the evil, maybe that's not the right word, but the dictators of the world, North Koreans, Iranians, etc., they're all pals, you know, all helping Russia. You know, these guys are friends, and the West doesn't seem to be too united from my perspective. So maybe, you know, that the war has been suggested as emboldening these dictators. You know, maybe they will do something, you know, to the West. I mean, one of the things that is fascinating is the subject of asymmetric warfare. From a few months ago, was it 6 months ago? Operation Spiderweb, which got all the world's attention. Are the Ukrainians, they're smart people. Took them, they said, 2 years to plan that. Put drones inside of Russia by bribing, you know, truck drivers and just seducing people and, like, you know, just selling, bullshitting and but they basically convinced, they persuaded people to take these drones unknowingly, and then the drones activated remotely and destroyed aircraft and infrastructure. That has woken up the world's militaries. People could attack America from inside America. How does air defense help you if suddenly drones launch from truck doors that open and attack a stadium full of people? It's scary. It's like Black Mirror stuff, you know? So, yeah, I mean, but to go back to your question, Eric, we can't see, sadly, an end to the war. It will end, but only when Putin dies. Unless somebody kills him, you know? But I don't see him dying soon.
But when I watched the movie, the first chapter was excitement about the potential for Ukraine. Then the second chapter was just shock, what had happened with the invasion. And now, in today, the third chapter is almost a resilience, but it seems a fragile resilience. It doesn't seem as though, I don't know what the message was that you were wanting to get across, but there certainly is resilience. But you got a feeling from the people that they're living one day at a time.
They're living, so you pick, then you got it. So that's the message. Life goes on, they're living one day at a time, they're brave and resilient. And as I shared, the next chapter is about exhaustion. So that, like, your wording was good, fragile resilience. It's very fragile. Like, people are at breaking point. If Putin is trying to break Ukraine, he's doing a good job. I can't say he's succeeded, but people are exhausted. People are on edge. People are angry. You know, they're angry. They're angry. They are tired. They are in pain. You know, I feel it, Alex. So, you know, it's just a sad story. And it's pointless, Alex. We don't understand the point of it. But what is the point of this war? No one knows.
And so what is the point of the movie? If you say that the war is pointless, what are you? Why did you invest all this time, energy, effort, money, love into this quite superb movie that you've put together? And as you say, the chapters are still to come, further to come.
So that's a nice question. I mean, the point of the movie was to share, like I said earlier, this enlightened narrative about what is Ukraine? What is modern Ukraine? What is the capital? It's a film's about the capital. Ukrainian culture, but it's in the capital. It shows the beauty of the capital. It shows the humor of the people. The quality of life. I mean, Russians are shocked. You've seen this over the news. You know, there's all these jokes about them stealing toilets, you know. But I mean, Ukrainians had a higher standard of living compared to their neighbor. And we were living a really, like, privileged life in Kyiv before the full-scale invasion, with amazing food and culture and beauty and laughter. We were booked to go and see Louis C.K., the famous comedian, that Saturday night. The bombs dropped on the Thursday. Saturday night, I had tickets to Louis C.K. in the center of Kyiv. And we obviously didn't go. He didn't make it to Ukraine. But everyone was coming to Kyiv. And everyone was coming. Madonna came. The Red Hot Chili Peppers came. Depeche Mode. I did my first trip to Kyiv. It was through an innocent university program that my friend was on, and he got an invitation and I went with him. And that, it was this December, I think it was either 18 or 19 years ago, this Christmas, and the big billboards, Depeche Mode in Kyiv. And every year up until the pandemic, there was every February Depeche Mode in Kyiv. And I thought, wow, never saw Depeche Mode signs in Joburg. You know, I love Depeche Mode. And everyone was coming to Kyiv. Filmmakers were coming there. We saw in the news, you know, it was Tom Cruise one day, then it was Jean-Claude Van Damme. He used to come often. Then it was Jared Leto. There was, like, big names coming. They were doing film recces, and Jean Reno from The Professional was shooting a film in Kyiv. And it was opening up as a place. People were starting to understand it. We never heard of crime in Kyiv. You know, I'm sure there was, but I never heard of it. It wasn't a big thing. People didn't drink and drive, contrary to the stereotypes. You know, like in London, you drink, you get a taxi, you leave your car. That was my experience. Maybe some other people are different, but that was my experience. My circle of friends all spoke English. The film was made, Alec, in English. to again challenge the stereotypes. People say they don't speak English there. Most people I know speak English there. Maybe not the best English, but some of them speak pretty perfect English. And that was again, so we were trying to show that Ukraine is a place worth learning about, worth understanding, worth visiting. And then the war started. Now, maybe you shouldn't visit until the war ends. But we're trying to show this is what the world will lose, Eric, if Ukraine disappears. This place was a tourist explosion waiting to happen. Everyone's looking for new experiences in life and new things to do. The eating, the landscape, the culture, the way they dress with those vishivankas and their own clothing. It's just beautiful. They've got, you know, the city of Kiev is 1,500 years old. You know, it was, there was no Moscow before there was Kiev. They're trying to rewrite history, but the Moscovites came from the Kievan Rus, where the place the Vikings found. You know, we were trying to capture in the film, you know, what the world can embrace and enjoy, you know, like, and then of course there's the sadness if it doesn't survive, you know, but Ukraine is a very smart place with smart people that are doing creative things. So many apps on my phone were made in Ukraine. We all use these apps and we go, we don't think where they come from, but a lot were made in Ukraine. You know, maybe the company is British or American or Israeli or German, but the developers are in Ukraine. You know, and there's lots and lots and lots of stories. I know you know a lot of entrepreneurs. Clickatel, you know that big story. What was his name? De Villiers? I don't know him, but I know of him. I'm sure their system, their platform was built in Ukraine. I'm trying to think of other South African platforms.
I know Grammarly, which I use all the time. Any writer should. That's a Ukrainian company.
Yeah, that's a pure homegrown Ukrainian unicorn. Absolutely.
But with all of that tech, surely that gives Ukraine an advantage at some point in this war. And I remember reading a book by Moises Naim, who's a exiled Venezuelan. Who works in very high esteem in the United States. And the book is called The End of Power. And in there, he was talking about how small nations can now beat big nations on the battlefield because of, well, technology. Is that not something that would be the hope for the Ukrainian people, that they've got all these smart techies, they have managed to wipe out dozens of long-range Russian bombers. Now, if they can get missiles, the long-range missiles that you mentioned earlier, that Flamingo, if they can start getting their own munitions, well, perhaps then the Russians would decide that it was too big a cost. Is that part of the narrative in Ukraine?
Absolutely. That's in the movie as well, the innovation of the people, the brain power. And I think your point is a very good point, because if they weren't so innovative, they might have lost already. You know, only through smart, cunning, creative thinking have they managed. It's David and Goliath. I mean, Russia seems to have endless money. You know, I don't understand. The money, the oil doesn't stop flowing. The gas doesn't stop flowing. And they just seem to have endless resources. Ukraine does not have endless resources. So they're up against this money monster that can buy, you know, drones from Iran and wherever else. And North Korea is giving them millions of rounds of ammunition. I mean, you know, whoever spoke about North Korea, no disrespect to North Korea, but whoever spoke about North Korea until this war in Ukraine? We never used to talk about North Korea. Now North Korean soldiers are fighting for Russia in Ukraine. North Koreans are making munitions for Russians, you know, like, wow, where did North Korea suddenly come from? You know, so if it wasn't for the Ukrainian brain power, we might not be having this discussion today. Maybe it could be over.
So we've spoken a lot about the movie. Before we go, how do you find it?
That's a good point. We actually didn't. So it's on YouTube. It's for free. It's a non-profit project. It started as a non-profit project, you know, many, many, many years ago before the full-scale invasion, because it was an inspired idea. It was, as I said, a labor of love, and in an attempt to basically try and elevate a conversation around Ukraine. Like, what is Ukraine? It's not the Ukraine. It's Ukraine. They make food. They make technology. They have fashion. They mine iron ore. They have rare earths. It's got history and culture. The Hasidics come from Ukraine. You know, if anybody is Jewish and Orthodox, I mean, Fiddler on the Roof, that famous Jewish musical, was written by Shalom Aleichem in Kiev, and it's set in a village outside of Kiev. You know, so there's so much history from that part of the world. Golda Meir comes from Kiev. I mean, you know, the list is so long. We would be over an hour just discussing who came from Ukraine. So you find it on YouTube, Kiev of Mine. Share it with your friends. It's very moving, if I say so myself. I mean, I'm part of the team, so you know, I hope that we did a good job. I think we did. The numbers are small, Eric. We're not famous filmmakers, Eric. I've known you a long time, and I've got about as much film credibility as you, and you haven't spent 20 years busting your chops.
That's not true at all. But it's true. You've had some good movies.
Doesn't mean we have credibility. Maybe with you, I've got some credibility. But if we phone, actually, Eric, this is a good point, because it's something that is incredibly interesting discussion. And Sean Penn did a podcast on this last year, speaking about, because he made a film called Superpower. I saw it. I wasn't crazy about it, but it's Sean Penn. And they battled to get it out there. And it's, you won't be able to find it. It's like, it's on Paramount Plus. It wasn't a big deal. Other than the Oscar-winning film, 20 Days in Mariupol, no films made about Ukraine in the last 3.5 years have got distribution. And the only reason that 20 Days in Mariupol got distribution is because it won the Oscar. I had the opportunity to meet the filmmaker. We had an hour Zoom call. He was incredibly gracious and forthcoming and kind and generous with his information. And he said, you know, it was a struggle for them. And since their film, there isn't another one. So Sean Penn was saying that there's a lot of Russian money being spent as part of their propaganda to squash Ukrainian culture. Is it true what he's saying? I don't know. But it certainly sounds possible. You know, there's a lot of Russian money in London influencing all kinds of things. You know, Russian money is everywhere. So Sean Penn said it is so hard to get a Ukrainian film about Ukraine distributed. No one wants to go near it. And we haven't seen another one. So we put it on YouTube after trying and trying. Eric, we couldn't get anyone to see the film. If Netflix, for example, watched it and said, it's rubbish, leave me alone, I'd say, well, thank you for watching it. They wouldn't even watch it. I couldn't get anyone. And you know me, Alec, I'm quite persistent. I've got quite a good network. I had a lot of people, some of them you know well, are high-powered people helping me. We couldn't get anyone to watch the film. Wasn't they watched it and said, it's nonsense. Couldn't get them to watch it. For whatever reason. Also, sadly, Ukraine is not in the public eye like it was a few years ago. The Middle East has also, you know, taken pole position in terms of media attention. And people have also tired of it. Like I said, here in London, the comments, isn't that war over long ago? It's like, I don't understand it. I don't really get it, you know? So we put it on YouTube. There's no monetization. It's a beautiful piece of work. The commentary is very encouraging. And it's doing exactly what it's meant to do. If you look at the comments, people are saying things like, wow, I knew nothing about Ukraine. This place looks amazing. And we go, that was the whole point. And that's why we say to people, help Ukraine, support Ukraine, tell people about Ukraine, give money to the army. If Ukraine disappears, this amazing place will not be enjoyed by you, me, or anyone else. And it's an amazing place that makes food for, I think, 20% of the world, the wheat. You know, I think it could even be 25%, but it's a significant number. You know, I know on Google it says Ukraine is responsible for 70% of the food in Egypt, for example. And a lot of North Africa and the Middle East relies on Ukraine for food. So, and they're still shipping the food, and even though it's incredibly dangerous. And even though it stopped for a while and they had to get corridors, the UN, but they basically got rid of the Ukrainian, they got rid of the Russian Navy in the Black Sea. The Ukrainians don't even have a navy. I'm talking about your point about innovation, where they see drones and they don't have a navy, and they pushed out the Russian Navy, the famous Black Sea Fleet. It's like, you know, that I mean, there's so many memes about that as well, and jokes about, you know, about that, you know. But the one thing the Ukrainians have is a very wicked and developed sense of humor. It's again against the stereotype. People used to say to me, Ronnie, but there's nothing fun about Ukraine. You said, you know, you've never been there. What are you talking about? It's a funny place. The president is a stand-up comedian. He's a very funny guy. Although his job right now is not funny at all. But he's a funny guy. You know, I've seen him make jokes. He's funny, you know. He's a funny guy. And the Ukrainian stand-up comedy movement is strong. It's dark humor. People going to bomb shelters and saying, welcome to the comedy evening, because there's like a built-in audience at a bomb shelter. They can't go anywhere. It's a dark start, but it's funny. You know, it's funny. You know, Stephen Fry was in Kiev a few times. He's very funny. You know, so Stephen Fry, he's a funny man, and he's trying to help Ukraine, you know, putting out positive stories and, again, challenging the stereotypes. We need more of it. We need more of it, you know. So the movie's on YouTube. I hope that you can put it on the screen, the address, you know. We didn't actually mention in the beginning, but it's free to watch. There's no monetization of it. All we ask is people tell your friends to watch it. And as a South African, you know, considering the South African government's position, it'll be great if more South Africans understood about what is Ukraine and what the world could lose if Ukraine disappears, because it'll be a huge other tragedy. And it's not guaranteed that Ukraine will survive. I believe they will. I believe there's more pain to come, a lot more pain to come. And I believe these are dangerous times. But I believe Ukrainians are resilient. Like you said, it's a fragile resilience for sure. They are exhausted. They're also exhausted of their own internal problems, the corruption and other things like that, which is so unfair considering there's a war. How can there be corruption in a war? But there is. But the Ukrainians I know are good, hardworking, wholesome people. You know, I don't know bad Ukrainians. I'm sure they exist. Just like Ukrainian crime exists, I never experienced it. I never had any fears walking around at night in the city. But I'm sure it does exist. But it wasn't a thing there.
Ronnie Aptika, South African entrepreneur, filmmaker, and Ukrainophile, I guess you could call it. Thank you for sharing your story with us today, and also for giving us the backstory to a movie that is available to all on YouTube. And I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.